The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. The first article that I want to share with you today was submitted by Alice Schott, and it's titled, Helping Fight Polio in 1952. I cherish a photo taken 72 years ago when I, along with my older sisters, Glenna and Karen, lived with our parents, Glenn and Ann Anderson, in a great neighborhood for 15 years. I'm the youngest daughter in our family, born in 1943. I was able to enjoy my first 10 years of life living among my neighborhood friends. A few of us became lifelong friends. We all lived within two blocks of each other. Back then, none of us had a television, and each home had only one phone. However, every home had a huge radio in the living room where the family gathered around in the evening to listen to their favorite shows and the world news. There were a few large yards where we kids would meet up and play all sorts of fun, active games. We could always rely on someone to have a bat, ball, jump rope, or a pocket full of marbles or jacks to play with. Many of us also had a large swing set with a slide and acrobat bar in our yards. Reading comic books was a huge pastime for all of us. We would get together a couple of times a month and exchange comics with each other. We kids didn't seem to have a care in the world until polio came into our lives. It was a very scary time for the neighborhood families. Our parents were very concerned for all our welfare. The newspaper was delivered to our front porch every morning, and polio was in the news almost every day. There were photos of the large iron lung machines that someone with polio had to live in to be able to breathe. Thousands of people of all ages were either paralyzed or died from polio. We didn't want this to happen to any of us. We wanted to help in the fight against polio, hoping doctors would find a vaccine. We asked our parents, "What can we do?" A neighborhood meeting was scheduled with all the parents and children. It was decided that we would band together and have a polio benefit carnival, with the proceeds going to the Polio Research Center. All the fathers supervised the event. They helped cook and sell hot dogs, potato chips, and popcorn. The mothers got busy making various kinds of pastries to sell. Their yummy pastries sold out by the end of the evening. The older kids organized game booths. For a 5 or 10 cent fee, you could play a game to win a small prize or get your face painted. We also had a fortune teller who got all his wisdom from shaking up a black ball, turning it upside down, and reading different messages from inside the ball. Pure magic for sure. The younger kids, like me, we were all assigned to help an older kid who was in charge of a booth. Also, if any parent needed a runner for something, they would call upon one of us younger ones to do that errand. Our polio benefit was a huge success. We kids were so proud of ourselves. The newspaper sent a photographer out the next day. We were all there cleaning up the yard and taking down the booths. We made $120, equivalent to about $1,400 today, toward the fight against polio. I assure you that when I was in elementary school, standing in line waiting for the pink sugar cube that contained the vaccine for polio, I felt very proud that I and my neighborhood gang had helped doctors find a cure for polio. Since we'll be celebrating the first day of spring on March 20th, I wanted to read you a couple of spring-related stories. And the first one is Spring Cleaning in the Good Old Days. Just as in the spring a young man's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love, so in the good old days a homemaker's mind turned to thoughts of spring cleaning. As a teen growing up in Bicknell, Indiana during the early 1950s, I knew my mother's thoughts would soon lead in that direction, and I knew I would be included in the process of spring cleaning our home. My mother wasn't any different from other women of her generation. When roses and peonies began blooming, Mom started to get spring cleaning fever. It was an unwritten rule that the house had to be turned upside down to get rid of the dirt and dust that had collected during the winter. Most homeowners at that time warmed their houses with coal, which caused coal dust to settle over everything inside the house, from ceiling to floor. First, our 9x12-foot rug was thrown over the clothesline and beaten with a wire carpet beater that probably had been handed down to us from my maternal grandmother. That was one of my jobs as a teen, to beat the dust from the carpet. After that was accomplished, Dad helped Mom carry the rug to the front yard, where she used a mixture of ammonia and soap to scrub every inch of it. I always hated the smell of ammonia and wondered how Mom could stand to be so close to it. But I must admit, after the rug dried, it was noticeably brighter than it had been when Mom started on it. Another chore of mine was to use a modeling compound product on the ceilings and walls to remove any coal dust. It was almost miraculous the way that glob of clay removed dust and grime. It was a lot of work, especially when I had to clean the ceiling by standing on a ladder. When the piece of clay became too dirty, I grabbed a clean hunk and started swiping the wall again. When using coal to heat homes went out of favor, the manufacturers of that modeling compound changed the name of their product to Play-Doh and sold it as a toy for children. Spring cleaning always meant all the curtains needed to be washed. The cotton lace curtains on the living room windows needed special treatment. After Mom washed them and starched each panel heavily, curtain stretchers were placed in the front yard. We very carefully attached each curtain to the stretcher, which had small tacks or large pins all around the edges of the frame to hold the shape of the curtains while they dried. The goal was to attach the curtains to the pins without getting stuck and having a finger bleed on the clean curtains. Another task Mom thought was necessary for spring cleaning was to carry the mattresses outside so they could air. We first arranged chairs and boxes in the backyard to place the mattresses on. Complicating matters, we didn't have a real stair step outside the kitchen door. Instead, Dad had placed a plank across two cement blocks to serve as a step. It was sometimes a challenge to safely carry a heavy mattress outside when stepping on that unstable plank. One time, when I was a young teen, Mom and I started laughing as we were carrying a mattress. We had to take a time out to stop laughing in order to get the heavy mattress outside. It wasn't all drudgery. We found ways to make it more palatable. Some people placed their coal stoves outside in the spring and put a flue stopper on the wall where the pipe was inserted. The pipe was taken outside and the built-up soot was knocked from inside the pipe. That was a dirty job that I tried to avoid. I don't remember my parents ever moving their stove, but my paternal grandparents did. Their stove was placed on the front porch during the warm months. Then Grandma Smith moved the furniture in the living room for a change of scene until the coal stove was brought back in for the fall and winter months. Coal stoves came in a variety of sizes and shapes. The more expensive ones had a lot of silver chrome. The stoves produced a lot of heat, but it was almost a full-time job to carry coal inside and take the ashes out. Some people might like to romanticize the good old days, but I would never want to go back to pot-bellied stoves for heat or washing machines and tubs for doing the laundry. Nevertheless, I did get some fond memories from those spring cleaning chores. Flying a kite is a good springtime activity, and I've got a story for you from J. Bernie Dibble, and it's titled, Go Fly a Tiny Kite. In the 1930s, the little town of Rochelle, Illinois, celebrated Memorial Day with all kinds of activities in addition to the customary parade. There were baseball games, swimming races in Spring Lake, and so on. But one year, there was a kite-making and flying contest. Notices of the contest were all over town, in stores, on billboards, in the newspaper, with this attention-catching headline, Go Fly a Kite. This common expression usually means, get out of here, or mind your own business, or quit bothering me. But in this case, it meant there were going to be prizes for the biggest kite, the prettiest kite, the highest flying kite, and the winners in several other categories. All the kites had to fly, no matter their other attributes. But the category I was interested in was making and flying the smallest kite. One of my indoor hobbies was building model airplanes. I didn't build solid models, but the kind that were light and flyable, made of balsa wood and tissue paper. Model kits with a 12-inch wingspan were 10 cents, and the 18-inch ones were 25 cents. This was my first procedure. First, I thumbtacked the plans on a breadboard and then covered them with wax paper. Next, I pinned the sticks from the kit to the plans, and with banana oil fast-fixing glue, I built the fuselage, wings, rudder, and stabilizers. Then I covered all the parts with tissue paper and sprayed them with water from my mother's atomizer, which shrank the paper to make it taut when it was dried. Finally, I assembled the various sections. The propeller was rubber band powered. Some of the models I put together actually flew. When I was through playing with them, I hung them from the ceiling of my room. When I got tired of them, I flew them out the window of my room and watched them crash in the garden. So for the kite contest, I got to work using the skills I'd developed with airplanes. I built my kite out of balsa sticks and tissue paper. It was about 6 inches long and 4 inches wide. I knew that the main horizontal spar had to be curved, so I borrowed a round-bottomed bowl from the kitchen, carefully bent a 4-inch length of balsa around it, painted it with special model liqueur, let it dry, and voila! I had a curved spar. I glued the longitudinal spar to it. I used thread from my mother's sewing kit to form the outside borders and then laid tissue paper over it, gluing it to the spars and thread borders. Then I sprayed it with water and let it shrink until it dried. After it dried, I tied a tiny little ribbon on the kite for a tail and used a spool of my mother's sewing thread for the flying string. I tested it in the alley between our house and the church. There wasn't much wind there, so I ran with it. It actually flew and stayed up as long as I ran with it. I was ready. The great day finally came. I was a bit in awe as I saw all the older boys with their big or pretty or unusually shaped kites. But I also noticed that my kite was by far the smallest one in the lineup of little ones. Now, if it would only fly and stay up. My turn came. There was a nice breeze that took my kite up and up and up. I don't remember how long it had to fly to qualify, but whatever the amount of time was, I met the criterion and won the contest. I don't even remember what the prize was. It was probably a real kite. The last spring-related article I want to share with you is about starting a garden. And Sarah Etchen Baker submits an article that's titled, Plantin' Season. March was and still is my favorite month of the year. Even now, I enjoy breathing in the crisp, clean air and watching the trees begin to blossom. The days grow longer and warmer. The birds chirp once again, heralding spring's arrival. More important, though, March is planting season, as my dad liked to call it. March was the month when he began to transform our backyard into a bountiful garden full of fresh fruits and vegetables. When planting season began in 1961, Dad roused me from a deep sleep. "Today's the day," he said, his face beaming. "Put on your gardening clothes, grab your gear, and meet me in the backyard. It's planting season. Hurry up now, time's a-wastin'." I quickly dressed in a pair of old denim jeans, a long-sleeved flannel shirt, and my gardening boots. I grabbed some peanut butter toast for breakfast on my way to the garage. There, I rummaged through the shelves until I found my gardening apron, gloves, and straw hat. Excitement fluttered deep in the pit of my stomach as I raced toward the backyard, pausing momentarily to smell the damp earth and relish the feeling of the warm sun on my skin. I passed our old pecan tree with fresh, new leaves on its branches, stretching out like welcoming arms, and then found Dad walking off a 15-by-15-foot space. This is the most level place in the backyard. It's the perfect spot with plenty of sunshine, he said enthusiastically. We worked together pulling weeds and removing grass before he tilled the soil. I stood on the sidelines and watched Dad, his calloused hands gripping the handles of the tiller as he plowed through the rich soil. With awe, I observed the dirt being turned over, revealing its dark, fertile secrets. He shoveled compost over the area, which I raked, making sure the compost was evenly distributed over the garden area. After a quick lunch, we drove to the local feed and seed store with the truck's windows rolled down, the smell of fresh spring air flowing across our faces and sweaty brows. As we made our way into town, I gazed out the window, staring at the planted fields and envisioning our own garden blooming with life. We arrived at the store, which was abuzz with customers and filled with the familiar scents of soil and seeds. "Here's a list of the vegetable seed packets for you to pick out," Dad said, handing me a somewhat crumpled piece of paper with dirt smudges on it. The list included my favorites: cucumbers, radishes, watermelon, lettuce, squash, bell peppers, tomatoes, chives, and potatoes. I carefully placed each seed packet in our basket and found Dad standing in line at the register waiting to check out. We loaded up the truck with our purchases: a new shovel for Dad, a new hand trowel for me, new gardening gloves, and other miscellaneous gardening items. We made our way home filled with a sense of expectancy and excitement. Back home, I noticed something different as I passed by the old pecan tree. A small wooden sign hung from one of the branches. It read, "Etchen Family Garden." "Look what your mom did while we were gone," Dad chuckled and ruffled my hair. For the remainder of the day, Dad and I worked side by side, digging deep holes and carefully placing a seed inside each one, covering them with a thin blanket of dirt and mulch. The work was hard, but I enjoyed every moment of it. Days and weeks went by, and our garden slowly came to life. The once barren land was filled with vibrant colors and delicious smells. I frequently joined Dad when he tended the garden, watering it and nurturing it with love, care, and patience. When harvest season finally arrived, we were rewarded with the most delicious and bountiful crop. Even now, when I think back to planting season, I feel a sense of pride. Ours wasn't just a garden. It was a symbol of our family's love and hard work. As the seasons changed and the vegetables grew, so did our bond. The old pecan tree still stands, as does the now faded sign that hangs beneath its open arms. Every time I see that sign, I'm reminded of the day in mid-March when Dad taught me more than planting. Through gardening, I developed an appreciation for the seasons and rhythms of nature and life itself. I learned observation skills, patience, living with faith, developing a sense of expectancy, and enjoying the fruits of one's labor. Most of all, I cherished the time I spent with Dad, our very own special father-daughter time in which my love and admiration for him grew and remains in my heart to this day. And our next article is titled, An Unforgettable Speech, and it's submitted by Doug Daughtry. Highlights in Boys Life magazines and Superman comics were popular reading materials for young boys in the 1960s. In the pages of these publications, one could find engaging puzzles, instructions on tying knots and starting campfires, and a virtuous hero with superpowers whose only weakness was an imaginary green element, kryptonite. But besides their more prosaic uses, if, say, a young boy carefully read the small print in the back of the magazines and comics, he would find ads for all sorts of oddities, including seahorses, Charles Atlas strongman training, small items he could sell and be rewarded with a BB gun, and of all things, explosive loads for cigarettes and cigars. That last one was just too much of a temptation for my brother Steve and me. My dad smoked cigars. He would almost always be found when working with a smoking brown Tampa Nugget cigar clamped in his teeth. The smoke would curl around his face and drift into the atmosphere. He was a successful businessman with a family business that sold fuel oil to thousands of homes and businesses in the Chattanooga area. He did well, becoming a national leader in that sector. Once, he was invited to give a speech at the National Oil Man's Convention in Philadelphia at a large convention hall. His oration was well thought out, typed, and rehearsed. It was a signal event in his career. He bought a new suit, tie, and gray felt trilby hat and had shined his black leather wingtips. By all accounts, he was well prepared. What he didn't know was that his two youngest sons had also prepared. We had ordered explosive loads from a comic book, and oh yes, we put them in my dad's cigars before he boarded the plane to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Those little loads looked like small white spikes. We had a small 10 of them. When Dad, dignified and honored, took the stage after he was introduced, he told a joke or two and prepared to report important data and trends in the business realm to several thousand people. In those days, it was unremarkable for a man to publicly smoke in such circumstances. My father lit his stogie, cleared his throat, and began. "Fellow oil men of the United States," he said, "I come to you with good news about the future of our industry." He lifted his right arm and took a pull from the cigar. The tip lit bright red. Kapow! Cinders, gray ash, and little brown tobacco leaves went everywhere. Startled, I can only imagine, my dad stood there, cigar in shreds like a horizontal mushroom. At first he was perplexed, but then he did something quite extraordinary. He laughed, as did the entire crowd. It was the high point of the convention, the one thing everyone told their friends and families back home. I can only speculate that it was the only reason we were never punished. In fact, the incident was never brought up in my presence. When I think of my dad, or even my grandfather, one thing I think of is cigars. They both enjoyed them. When I recall this single prank, I reflect on Dad's sense of humor and humanity. He certainly appreciated the honors, but somewhere there was an even deeper appreciation of the strange humor of his little boys. And next, Margaret Britton submits a short story titled Family Outings. I spent my elementary years in the northern latitudes of Minnesota. I entered first grade in 1955. For young children in that time and place, there was ease and simplicity. Lakes and forests and fields covered the region of my early childhood. I recall outings when my father took our family for late afternoon drives on the blacktop roads. He would drive slowly along as we watched for the beautiful fowl of that area. The birds of field and forest would sometimes scurry out from their nesting places. We were especially on the lookout for quail and pheasant and partridge. My younger brother and I learned to identify those birds by their lovely plumage and colorings. For those family outings, my mother would pack a paper bag with fresh apples and candy bars. At some point along our way, my father would turn onto a gravel road that led into the woods. There, he would pull over and stop, and my mother would pass around the bag filled with treats for us. Those times together in the family car, out of the countryside, still give me, decades later, a very warm memory. And here's some flashback fun. On March 16th in 1971, Lynn Anderson won a Grammy for Best Country Vocal Performance for her version of I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. And here's a famous quote by Vincent van Gogh. For my part, I know nothing with any certainty, but the sight of the stars makes me dream. And do you remember what land and sea creature seemed to burst right off the screen at moviegoers? Do you remember who it is? The Gill Man in Creature from the Black Lagoon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.